You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. My mum always used to say I'd lose my head if it wasn't attached. So far, I'm doing fine, but I do lose things all the time. Today, we have stories of people who also know what that feels like. Let's meet Todd.
You barely have hair on your legs and the back of your legs.
I don't anymore.
And you don't?
I waxed them last night. Not wax. I use hair removal cream because shaving just is like too painful.
It's too painful. Really?
Shaving leaves them too prickly.
Right.
Versus I've found hair removal cream is pretty good.
Yeah.
As long as you don't try and go too far up the thigh.
So like...
If you start going too far up the thigh towards the...
It burns, right?
Yeah. It burns. I'm Todd. And I'm a budding triathlete. So as a child, I was always someone that was pretty interested in extracurricular activities. I mean, admittedly, as a kid, you weren't calling it extracurricular activities. I was just calling it going and riding a bike after school. That was absolutely what I loved doing. Then when I started moving into high school, I started developing a real passion for music. Started doing opera singing, which is a little bit different. So did a bunch of productions with Opera Australia.
Was that at the Opera House?
It was indeed.
That's pretty cool.
Fantastic memory to have performed at the Opera House over 40 times over 5 different operas, all before the age of 14, 15. I'm incredibly lucky. Like, that doesn't happen to most people.
And then you stopped. What happened?
Well, I didn't necessarily stop, but my voice changed. I remember auditioning for one final opera, and the chorus master at that time, he tapped me on the shoulder and just smiled at me. He's like, "I know you really want this, but I can't give it to you because your voice is about to change." And he was bang on the money. Literally a week or two later, my voice changed.
What a voice! Young Homer's going to make me a millionaire! Hey, my voice just changed.
I went to university, I was still doing some singing, but I didn't really have an avenue for it. A few years after that, I was actually fortunate enough to live with a housemate who was really into triathlon. So I hadn't really heard much about the sport, didn't know anything about it. I'd done quite a lot of swimming in high school, I'd done a bit of running, and as I mentioned earlier, I loved riding my bike as a kid. So I bought a bike off a work colleague at the time. Slowly got into it, and then I was like, right, well, I'll just start running again, as I had done. So I started running again, and then, right, I started swimming again, and I just pieced the three together and signed up for my first triathlon. Previously, where maybe you were doing the singing to bring others satisfaction, with triathlon, there is a hugely selfish and personal element to it. I do it for myself in many respects. The other big reason that I got into it was actually as a means to raise money for charity. I had an auntie who was going through a battle with breast cancer at the time. And then in my decision to do another triathlon, I was like, right, I want something good to come of this. I want to use this as a way to actually raise funds. So I partnered with the Breast Cancer Institute of Australia and used my first half Ironman triathlon as a way to raise money. So I'd been doing triathlon for a little while. I'd done maybe 5-6 races. And I was starting to toy with the idea of upgrading to a better bike.
What was the bike?
So the bike was a Merida Warp TT. So it's a time trial specific bike. It's a very aerodynamic frame. It's not particularly good at going around corners, not particularly good at going up hills because it's quite heavy. It is just made to go fast in a straight line.
For those who don't know bikes, analogies, is it the Lamborghini on steroids or is it like a, what is it?
A time trial bike is like a Formula One car. For those that don't understand bikes, yes, they're designed purely to go fast. Are they necessarily the most beautiful things to look at? No. It's not a cheap bike. It's the better part of $5,000. So it was a significant investment and a big step up from what I had been riding. It is actually, bar a car, the most expensive thing I'd ever purchased, yes.
Who did you tell that you bought this bike?
Probably the first person I called was my dad, because my dad was quite into cycling. I'd been telling him about it when I was shopping for it, so he was the first person that I told that I'd bit the bullet and bought it.
What did he say?
interestingly enough, he wasn't trying to talk me out of it. I think a lot of people would try and talk you out of buying a $5,000 bike because that just seems like a crazy amount of money to spend. But the way he rationalized it to me was, you don't have a particularly lavish lifestyle. This is your hobby. This is what you're passionate about. You don't have any other vices, like you're spending a ton of money on drugs or alcohol. If this is what you want to spend your money on, go for it. And also, my father is an accountant. So ever the accountant, the way he sold it to me was changeover cost. If I sell my old bike, get money for that, buy the new bike, the changeover cost is really only $3,000. So you'd be dumb not to. That was the way I rationalized it to myself anyway. Close your eyes and go to sleep. I will hold the mirror. So a little bit down the track, a couple of races later, I'm living in the inner west of Sydney, and I have three bikes in my apartment all of a sudden. It's kind of, I don't know how all of a sudden it had multiplied, but I had this crappy race bike that I was looking to sell. I had my road bike, which I did most of my training and riding on, and I had this sparkling new race bike, which I'd just spent all of my pennies on. One Sunday morning, I came back at around 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning. I came in via the fire escape because the lift wasn't working that day, and spotted my crappy old race bike sitting there in the lift well. And it actually took my brain a good 30 seconds to a minute to realize that was my bike. I was like, oh, that's strange. There's a bike here in this lift well that looks just like mine. And about a minute later, my brain went, oh, crap, that is mine. And my heart sank. You know that horrible feeling you get in the pit of your stomach where you kind of know the outcome already? So I ran down the stairs of the fire escape as well as one can run, wearing bike cleats and still with a bike in hand, nearly stacking it, ran to my storage cage only to find that the lock had been smashed off and my expensive brand new uninsured race bike was gone. Called my housemate, had him come down to come and hold the bike I still had and the one that I'd found in the stairwell. I called the police, got onto them straight away. And then the next phone call, and I think harder than having to call the police, was to call my dad to explain to him what had happened.
How did he react?
It was a phone call, so I couldn't see his facial expression, but I can just picture on the other end of the line the eye roll and the look of, I told you so. Why wasn't this bike insured?
When did he tell you to get it insured?
I think he'd told me since day one of buying this new bike that I should probably get it insured.
Why didn't you get it insured, Todd?
That's a very good question, Sarath. I have no excuses. When I was talking to a lot of people, they're like, aren't you angry? Like, oh, you know, it was probably, don't want to use derogatory terms, but it's probably some junkie who's stolen your bike or something like that. And it was really interesting that I didn't get that angry. I actually felt sad. And I'm not trying to say this to make myself sound like some hero, but I actually did. I felt empathetic because I thought, yeah, it's highly likely that someone who needs their next fix or really needs the money has stolen this bike. And so it helped me come to peace with it in going, if I looked at it through that lens, it's probably gone to someone who really needs this. I registered the bike on this website called Bike Vault. So Bike Vault is an organization that was actually set up by a bunch of ex-detectives in Victoria. So they're a non-for-profit organization. You can register your bikes that you own now. And absolutely, I would say to people, please do this. And in doing so, it's trying to eliminate the market for stolen secondhand bike sales. For a good couple of months there, I was coming home from work each day, almost a little bit obsessively. And I had to limit myself to an hour searching for my bike, trawling through it, thinking, it is highly likely that this person who's stolen my bike is going to try and sell it to get the cash. They're going to sell it on Gumtree, eBay, or Facebook Marketplace. I will find this bike. Just a regular day at work. And so my personal mobile rings, and I don't often answer it if it's an unknown number. But on this day, for whatever reason, I actually answered the phone, and it was a gentleman from Bike Vault, and he was calling to say, hey, I'm just letting you know, you're probably about to get a phone call from the police. I can't make any promises, but we have a lead, and we think we might have found your bike. and kind of then just hangs up. So those words are ringing in my ears. We think we might have found your bike. So, of course, I got my hopes up a little bit, but didn't want to get my hopes up too much.
Did you tell anyone?
Didn't tell anyone yet. At that moment? I didn't even have any time because literally 5 minutes later, I received the phone call from the police. It was a constable at the Liverpool police station, and he confirmed that my bike had turned up at a pawn shop, a store in Warwick Farm.
How did you feel?
I was kind of stunned, and I have to admit, I was actually a little bit disappointed, purely because I'd started bike shopping and I was excited about something else, and I felt like this was like slightly tainted good. But of course, I was overjoyed. I was going to be getting my bike back. Yeah, so I called my dad. He was dumbfounded. No one expected this bike to come back, and he said, "Aren't you lucky? Thank your lucky stars."
Did his eyes roll back forwards?
They did. So they'd done the full like 360 at this point. So having done an eye roll of why didn't you insure the bike, they then rolled back into the correct position, which I think he was relieved about because he'd been living like that for 7 months. So I get there, I'm in a little bit of a waiting pattern for a little while, just waiting for the store manager, but then the store manager finally sees me, asks for my ID, and then goes, "Yep, here's your bike." Wheels it out. Bike is absolutely fine, basically. It's got a couple of scratches on it.
Did you then call your dad once you got your bike back again?
Yeah. So again, it was probably a phone call to my dad and a phone call to my girlfriend saying, "Look, it's on the roof of the car. I'm driving home." Obviously, hands-free. I'm always safety first. But yeah, driving home, just letting everyone know that I had it and it looked fine and couldn't believe it. What goes around, comes around.
Hey, turn. Turn music up. Yeah. Goes around, comes around, what goes like goes a cycle, everything that comes around, goes around, goes down.
That story was by Sarath Chandra. Ryan Pemberton was the supervising producer. All the Best is a show where emerging Australian storytellers learn how to make audio stories. If you want to be a part of the show, you can start by pitching to us from anywhere in Australia. We also have a team of wonderful supervising producers to help you so you won't get lost. Email contact@allthebestradio.com. I found my first love on a lazy Saturday morning. She had long black hair, wore an incredible green and black catsuit, and her name was Shego. I could only see her on Saturdays because that's the only time Kim Possible was on free-to-air TV. Carl found his first love a little closer to home.
My story starts a long time ago, and it's the story of my first love. And it began in Tennant Creek with a journey where I was sent with my parents when I was 11, turning 12, to a boarding school in the middle of New South Wales. And I, at the school, you know, it was a big change going from Tennant Creek to a boarding school. But I met a young woman who I fell in love with, and over several years had this, it was love, but I never told her. And every day I would sit on the bench in the quadrangle between the girls' dorm and the boys' dorm, and we would, you know, talk and be friends. And this was 12 and then 13 and then 14, and it went on for quite a while. And then in year 9, my sister was in a lot of trouble for having too many boyfriends, and I'd never had one. And I was sitting on the bench with Catherine. Her name was Catherine Alexander. And she said to me, "Carl, I've got to tell you something. Terry the Gut has asked me to go out with her, or out with him." And she said, he's my boyfriend now and we won't be able to sit here anymore. And I was heartbroken, and I was 15. I was really heartbroken, and I decided that after crying myself to sleep night after night for weeks, that I'd never have anything to do with women ever again. No, I know it sounds funny, but it was true. And then I left. That the last time I saw her was actually the last kiss we had. And it was a church service at the end of the term, and I knew I was leaving because my parents had said, "You're not coming back to the school." But I didn't tell anyone. So I met her out the front, and the sun was setting, and it was, you know, a really long sunset down in the south, and I kissed her on the forehead, and I remember it. You know, it was a really intimate moment for me. But for her, it was like, "Oh, we'll see you next semester." But I never went back. Instead, my parents sent me to St. John's, and every day I went to the library and I read Mills and Boon novels, and I stayed away from women. And I did. I had girls that were friends, but there was nothing going to happen. And I eventually, you know, I'd exhausted Mills and Boons in the library, and I was now in year 11, and then I was going into year 12, and I was turning 18. And I went back to Tennant Creek for the school holidays, and I was, you know, it's a romantic place, which is, for me it is, you know. I actually think it is, because it's, if you live there, you get to know it, and it's actually an intimate, you know, there's intimate detail in the landscape of the desert. And I decided I'd send a Christmas card to Catherine Alexander, because I knew she lived in a place called Pine Hill, which had a post office. So I sent off this Christmas card, and I just said, "Hey, Catherine, you know, rah, 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 I'm going into year 12 and so are you." And from that moment on, we started to write letters to each other. And so for the whole of year 12, when I should have been studying, I was writing poetry and love letters, and I was pressing flowers, and it was very romantic. Oh, no. Anyway, there was a lot of letters, and you know, but we never talked. And so you have to think, this is 15, and then I was 18. And in the same year, three of my uncles started to go blind. My mother said, "Look, we've found out that we've got this disease in our family where people go blind in their 50s, and you need to go to Sydney, and there's this guy who's the expert on this, you know, blindness, and he's the only person that deals with it, and rah, 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 you do these tests." And that weekend that I was going to go to Sydney, Catherine Alexander was going to be there as well. And so, you know, after this 12 months of letter writing, and we would finally meet. So we arranged to meet, and my auntie Margaret, who was from New South Wales, she was going to chaperone me. She took me out, and I bought a pair of beautiful fluoro tropical pants, and I had a sort of Hawaiian shirt on, and it was, you know, I was very nervous, because letters are one thing, but actually meeting a person and, you know, seeing them after so many years of love, it's sort of like love that hadn't gone anywhere for me. And anyway, we get in the taxi, and we're staying in a hotel at the right end of Bondi Beach. And this was, the year would have been 1985, I think. So Bondi was different to what it is now, but it was a small hotel with three or four stories, and I'd never been to Sydney actually before, and it was a big city, and you know. Anyway, we get in the taxi, we go to leave to go and see Catherine Alexander at this prearranged date. I think her mother or auntie was going to be there too, because, you know, we were young and they didn't trust us, I don't think. But they, anyway, the taxi, we go down Bondi, and then my auntie realised she'd forgotten her purse, and she said, "Oh, taxi driver, go back. Got to go back and get my purse." So we turned around and we go back and we pull up. He does a U-ey on the street, and we pull up in the hotel again, and she says, "Run upstairs, here's the key," and it's, you know, on the desk next to the bed. And so I grabbed the key and I bolted up the stairs, and I was full of energy and I was exciting and I was, you know, this big event. And I get upstairs and I push open the door, and it was like an older style with, you know, the doors were opposite each other, and it was a corridor and they had numbers. And I ran in and I got sort of probably halfway down the hall, and I went, "Oh, why is it so dark in here? The lights should have come on." And the lights didn't come on. And then I sort of stopped, and I heard rrr, rrr, this deep growl from the other end of the corridor. And I was straining my eyes and looking down there, and I was like, "Shit, where am I? What's going on?" And then I hear the growl again, and then I hear a dog start to run at me. I turned around and I began to bolt for the door where I'd come in. And I grabbed the door, and as I grabbed the door, the dog bit me. It actually bit me more than once. It bit me on my right buttock, and, you know, it ripped open my pants, and there was a lot of blood. And the long and short of it is that I had to go to hospital, and I had to have stitches in my buttock. And I never made this meeting with Catherine Alexander, which, you know, it was terrible. It was strange too, because, I mean, you're all wondering, you know, okay, you must have had a phone number. And I did. I had a number in Sydney, and my auntie had talked to her and arranged this meeting. And you know, why wouldn't you just ring her and say, "Look, I'm sorry"? But I didn't. I was so kind of, I don't know, embarrassed in that awkwardness, you know. And I was turning 19, but I was a late bloomer, and I was immature, and I, you know, I'd never had a girlfriend. I wasn't interested in girls. Like I said, I'd gone, "Nah, I'm not going to do that because of what had happened." Anyway, I didn't go, which was strange, but I decided it must have been fate. You know, the dog had bitten me. I wasn't meant to meet her. That was it. And so for me, it was kind of like I left. I went back to Tennant Creek. I stayed in Tennant Creek for a year and a half, and then my younger brother decided to go to uni in Darwin, and he said, "You know, let's go to uni. You know, you should come too. It's all about girls and fun and drinking beer, not about study." But And so we came back to Darwin from Tennant Creek, and I was in Darwin, and I did have a girlfriend. I think I turned 21. It was my first kiss, and I other than kissing Catherine on the forehead, and I that didn't work, and I was more interested in girls now, sort of thing. And I had a couple of girlfriends, but still a virgin. And I went back to Tennant Creek, and it was, I think I was 23, so it was 19, like 4 or 5 years later. And I went back to Tennant Creek, and I was working in my parents' business and on uni holidays. And I had an old XC, which was my first car, the beautiful, I don't know who's had old cars, but it was like driving, you know, you sat in there, it was a boat, you have this huge bench seat, and it was, like, modern cars aren't like that, you know, they just don't have the same feel. And you just, you sit in there and you feel like you're in luxury, but you're not really, you know. But I used to, I did things like I literally would drive, I would see if I could stay in first gear in the main street of Tennant Creek and from one end to the other. Now, it wasn't that I was bored, it was just like I actually used to just relax and I'd listen to country and western music and, you know, and it wasn't illegal, it's actually not illegal, and if people don't think it's relaxing, try it. It's very relaxing to drive very slowly, as it is exciting to drive fast. So anyway, I was driving around and it was lunchtime and I decided to go, it was a back street of Tennant Creek, it's called Brown Street and it's where the industrial area is, and I had a friend that lived there in a flat and I was going to see, his name was Noel, and I was going to see Noel for lunch. And I was driving along and I saw a short wheel based Toyota with New South Wales number plates, and it was broken down and it had its bonnet up, and there was a guy and he had a blue shirt on, he had a baldy head, like a plate baldness, and he was standing there looking at his motor, and I was just a friendly person and my parents owned a spare parts shop and I worked, you know, knew about cars, and I pulled up. I said, "Hey mate, what's happening? You want a hand, you know, I'll take you to the mechanics," and we looked at his car and we fiddled his batteries and we tapped his solenoid and we did different things. And the sun was blaring down, and it was very hot. It was 40 degrees sort of thing, and he had one of those real old sort of 1970s wheelbase Toyotas that were common back then. Anyway, and he's like, yeah, I'm on a trip around Australia and I don't know what's going on. We've had all this trouble driving up from Alice and we've finally broken down in Tennant, you know, we're broken down, we need help. So I said, look, I'll tow you around to Mad Max's around the corner. So I was standing there and Max actually has moved to Darwin, everyone. He lives at Mandorah. He flies a gyrocopter. I don't know if anyone's been over there and seen it. You can do a gyrocopter tour. He's just as mad as he used to be, but he's in his 70s now. So he's like, anyway, Max, you know, I was going to take him to the Max and get his car sorted. And anyway, he puts down the lid of the car, the bonnet, and I look up and the person sitting in the seat looks up and it's Catherine Alexander, my first love. And which, you know, this is 10 years has passed. But it brought resolve for our story in a way, because she was with her fiancé, she was travelling around. I could tell her why I'd never met her at that date. That was my date with destiny that never happened, sort of thing. And I, you know, I didn't meet her, and we went to the Dolly Pot and we had a sizzling steak together, and we talked about why I hadn't met her in Sydney, and she said, well, you know, it was probably good because now I'm here with my fiancé and I'm travelling around. And I suppose the moral of my story is that love, you know, first love or any love, it has twists and turns. It moves about. You never know what's going to happen. And for me, my story, it was good that I met her and resolved it. And I've moved on. And tonight my wife's here, of course, which is my second love. Like, I haven't had many loves. I was very slow moving, in case no one got that. I had opportunity but never took it. No, but for me, love's always burnt very deeply. And, you know, it really has. And so I suppose my first love, I ask you all to remember back. You know, it can cause you happiness, but it can cause you pain. But it defines, in a way, your future loves, you know. And for me, it did too. It's like I've always been intense and intimate in my relationships. And, you know, they started with my first, really. Anyway, thank you.
That story was told by Carl Joswig. It was produced by Patrick Horton and Johanna Bell. This story was first told at Spun, a live storytelling night presented by Story Projects in the Northern Territory. You can subscribe to the Spun Stories podcast and find out more about the Spun Storytelling Project by visiting spunstories.net. You can also look for Spun Stories on Facebook and Twitter. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories, and pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. This episode was mixed and compiled by Ryan Pemberton. Our executive producer is Alison Chan. Jordan Fennell is our Victorian State Coordinator. The All the Best Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. And we now have two community coordinators. Danny Stewart has joined and we're so excited that she's officially on the team. Our SYN Community Coordinator is Erin Dick. Matilda Fay is our social media producer. And I'm your host, Maddie McQueen. Shining Bird composed our theme music and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find all of our other episodes at allthebestradio.com.